not just their monarch. Our friend is well aware of that, but what he's persistently overlooking is that a huge percentage of Chisomians will follow her straight into apostasy and heresy simply because of how much they love her. Every dispatch from Green Mountain and the Queen Mother only underscores that fact. He simply doesn't want to admit it, just as he's underestimating, in my opinion, the degree to which the Chisomian commons are going to be automatically suspicious of anything which holds even the slightest possible taint of some sort of aristocratic cabal. Every other scheme he's come up with for actually discrediting her has foundered on that same rock. But he honestly believes this one will work, because it's supposed to discredit the reasons for her decisions, rather than the decisions themselves, and do it in a way she can't directly counter. Unfortunately, I don't think it will have the effect he's predicting. And without Green Mountain's active support, which even he realizes would be impossible to secure, I'm even more doubtful about his ability to manage the commons well enough to keep the situation under control in the long run.
So am I, Halcombe said, nodding slowly and regretfully. And if he's wrong, if he can't discredit her policies and deprive her of the power to counterattack his actions, then we have no choice but to consider more direct action.
I understand, the man who'd asked the initial question said. I still wish there was some way to avoid it, though.
So do we all, Halcombe replied. So do we all.
He sat silent for several seconds, then returned his attention to the priest.
I take it you have his answer to our latest counter-proposal?
I do. He believes what you've suggested should be practical, given conditions in both Caris and Chisholm. He's agreed to help push events in the necessary direction.
And is he making any plans of his own to consolidate things in the aftermath?
Halcombe's eyes sharpened as he asked the question, and the other man shrugged.
He says there's no point in trying to do so at this time, or rather that it would be unduly risky to attempt to involve anyone else in his planning at this stage. As he says, his present base of support isn't especially strong, and he's not completely positive who among his apparent supporters might prove less than enthusiastic if they knew the full plan. So he intends to wait until the moment comes, then play it by ear. I think he entertains at least some hope of recruiting additional supporters when the Chisomian delegation to this new imperial parliament arrives in Telesburg. Even if he fails in that, or decides it's too risky to attempt after all, the fact that he's the only one in the palace who will know ahead of time that anything is coming should allow him to capitalize upon it. That's what he says, at any rate, and I'm strongly inclined to agree he's telling us the truth about his plans and intentions.
Which tends to lend additional credence to your own comment about his motivations, doesn't it?
Halcombe said a bit sadly.
I suppose it does. On the other hand, don't forget that his objections, his stipulations, are completely sincere. That's my evaluation of them, at least. There are clear limits beyond which he's not prepared to go.
The note of warning in the priest's voice was clear, and Halcombe nodded.
I realize that, and if I believed his analysis of the consequences of his own proposal was accurate, I'd be fully prepared to respect those limits. Unfortunately, he's wrong. What he wants to do is far too likely to come crashing down around his ears, and if it does, it will come crashing down on us and upon our task as well. In fact, I believe that ultimately his idea is likely to make things worse by actually strengthening Charlian's hand in the fullness of time. Never forget, my sons, that this new Empress of ours is a formidable, intelligent, and determined woman. One who not only has enormous popular support in Chisholm, but who's been steadily winning the hearts and loyalty of all of Karras as well. That's what makes her such a dangerous weapon in Caleb's hand, and striking her from his hand is going to be far more difficult than our friend believes.
I regret that, the priest said softly. As you said a moment ago, she isn't and never has been an evil woman, despite the horrible sin she's fallen into.
Evil seduces, Halcombe replied almost equally softly. It cannot conquer by force of arms unless godly men allow it to do so. And if its mask were not so fair and so seductive, then hell would be empty of all save Shan Wei herself. But hell is not empty, my son, and however good Charlian's intentions may originally have been, however good she may still sincerely believe they are, she is fully in the service of Shan Wei now. And so, however likable she may be, no matter how physically or even spiritually attractive she may be, she is the enemy of God. And there can be no quarter, no compromise with his enemies.
The others nodded in solemn silence, and he redirected his attention to the priest once again.
Very well. When you have the opportunity to speak to him once again, tell him it will take at least a short while to make the arrangements from our side. If he seems to be feeling impatient, point out to him that the difficulties involved in finding a secure and, if necessary, defensible location for our base after the actual strike are far from trivial. Tell him we'll complete our preparations as quickly as possible and inform him when everything is in place. And it might be as well to suggest to him that he begin thinking of ways to bring St. Agatha's to the Empress's attention.
With all due respect, do we want to have him do that before our preparations are complete? The priest asked.
I think it will be better to lay the groundwork as far in advance as possible, Halcombe replied. Given how complicated and busy her life must be at the moment, however many of Caleb's advisers may still be available to assist her, it's unlikely she'd be able to free the time in her schedule to visit the convent before we could be prepared. Even if our friend is clumsier than I would expect about mentioning St. Agatha to her, she isn't going to be able to go herring off on a moment's notice.
The priest nodded, and Halcombe inhaled deeply, pushed back his chair, and stood.
In that case, my sons, he said, raising his hand and signing the scepter, go now with God's blessing and in Langhorne's keeping. Remember the devotion and love due to God and the archangels, and let the strength that love brings you strengthen and guide your hands, hearts, and minds as we give ourselves to the service of God and Mother Church against all enemies of the light.
6. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
Well, this ought to be an interesting dog-and-dragon show, a voice muttered quietly,
and Vicar Samuel Wilson looked up as his brother settled into the chair beside him.
Not perhaps the most tactful or safe thing to say,
Samuel replied even more quietly.
Maybe not, but that doesn't make it inaccurate,
Howard Wilson half-growled.
No, Samuel agreed. Well then,
Howard shrugged, and Samuel grimaced. Actually, there was a sufficiently wide moat of empty chairs around the two Wilson brothers that the likelihood of anyone overhearing a private conversation between them was virtually non-existent.
On the other hand, Samuel hadn't survived this long by running unnecessary risks. Still, he understood his younger brother's profoundly mixed feelings as they waited, along with perhaps 40 or 50 other vicars and senior archbishops, for the tribunal to convene.
How many years have we been collecting evidence of corruption, especially in the Office of Inquisition? Samuel asked himself. We must have enough of it to fill a dozen trunks by now. Large trunks. Yet with all those years, all that effort, we have yet to secure a serious indictment of anyone. And now this.
There had been times when Samuel had been sorely tempted to abandon his quixotic quest. The chances of success, even if he somehow, someday, found himself stepping into the office Clinton and his successors had corrupted so thoroughly, were slim. He knew that. He'd always known it. And even if he somehow achieved that goal, it would be only to find himself battling literally generations of entrenched opposition and self-interest. Yet he was who he was, and the unending and generally thankless task of reforming the church and purging it of its many abuses had become a Wilson legacy.
And a damned risky legacy it is, too, he thought moodily.
He'd actually preferred charges against at least a dozen of his fellow Schulerites over the years, whenever he could produce the necessary evidence, without exposing the circle's broader, covert, and far riskier activities. At least twice, he'd had absolutely conclusive evidence that the inquisitors in question had been using their office and all the grisly threats associated with it to extort money out of completely innocent men and women. And once, he'd had almost absolutely conclusive evidence of murder. Yet the most severe punishment he'd ever managed to secure had been no more than a 1-year suspension from the Order of Schuler. And that had been for one of the extortionists, not the murderer. It sickened him that his own order, the order charged with preserving the sanctity of the church's own soul, was even more corrupt than the other orders it was supposed to guide and police. Yet there was no point in pretending that wasn't true. And the worst of it was that many of those corrupt inquisitors didn't even realize they were corrupt. They were part of a system far larger than themselves, performing their duties exactly the way they'd been taught to perform them by Jaspar Clinton and his immediate predecessors. The thought that they genuinely believed they were serving God's will was frightening. Yet he'd long ago come to the conclusion that, for many of them, it was also true.
I sometimes wonder if even Clinton truly realizes how corrupt he is. In fact, I doubt he does. He doesn't see it as corruption at all, which is probably the most damnable thing about him. I think he genuinely sees no discrepancy between what he wants and the will of God. They're exactly the same thing, which is why he's justified in doing anything, anything at all, to achieve his own ends. Anything that maintains and strengthens the church's authority, and his, is good and godly. Anything that threatens the church's authority, and his, is the work of Shanwei herself. And no one else, except for the circle, cares a damned thing about it, as long as it keeps working for them, keeps squeezing out money and power and privilege for them.
The truth was, although Samuel hadn't told anyone, even among his brothers of the circle, that he actually agreed with Michael Stainer and the Church of Caris. The Church of God Awaiting was hopelessly corrupt, trapped in the grip of men like Clinton and the rest of the Group of Four. Even if he could somehow topple Clinton and Trenaire, there was no point deceiving himself into the belief that there weren't at least a score of other vicars prepared to step into the Group of Four's place and maintain business as usual. It was simply the way things were.
But there truly are good and godly men among the vicarate as well, he told himself stubbornly.
You know there are. That's the only reason you haven't given up and fled to some place like Karis yourself. Perhaps so, but it was getting harder to cling to that belief. And the air of desperation, the sense of men willing to reach for any avenue of escape, which had permeated the church at her highest level since the Carisians had bidden the group of four defiance, was frightening. What had been merely dangerous before had become something far worse, and after the ghastly fate handed out to Arake Dinis, Samuel Wilson was under no illusion about that. Frightened men would turn savagely upon anyone who appeared to threaten their own safety, their own positions, and Jaspar Clinton was more than prepared to use that fear to support his own ends. Perhaps it's time, he thought. If the key wasn't given for a moment like this one, then why was it given? Surely an internal threat to the church is just as deadly as an external one? Yet it wasn't the same thing, and he knew that as well as Howard did. Perhaps the time was coming, but until it did. Samuel Wilson's ruminations broke off abruptly as the members of the tribunal filed into the large chamber and seated themselves behind the enormous conference table. There were eight of them, but only one who really mattered, and Wilson's face tightened as Willem Reyno, the Archbishop of Changwu and Adjutant of the Order of Schuler, leaned forward and lightly rapped on the small bell hanging in its stand before him. The sweet, silvery notes floated through the chamber, and the quiet buzz of side conversations ended abruptly.
"This tribunal is now in session," Reyno announced. "Let us pray."
Heads bowed throughout the chamber, and Reyno raised his voice.
O God, creator of all men, maker of all things, designer and architect of all that has been, is now, or ever shall be, we come before you in awe and trembling. We beseech you to guide us in this, our solemn task to maintain the sanctity, the purity, and the truth of your word and your church, as handed down to us by the Archangel Langhorne on the very day of creation itself. We thank and bless you for giving us that sacred instruction and guiding us in its preservation and teaching. And it is with a heavy heart we bring you the result of the deliberations and decisions to which your office of Inquisition has been called by recent events. Be with us, we beseech you, as we contend with the forces of darkness in your most holy name. In Langhorne's name we pray, Amen.
A chorus of answering amens rumbled back, but Samuel Wilson's was not among them, nor was his brother's. Reyno raised his head, waited for his listeners to settle themselves comfortably once again, then cleared his throat.
I'm confident that everyone in this chamber is fully conversant with the events which led to the assembly of this tribunal, he said. Since that is the case, there seems little point in summarizing them yet again.
One or two heads nodded among the audience, and Reyno looked over his shoulder at one of the aides assembled against the tapestry-covered wall behind the tribunal's members. The aide, a remarkably young-looking upper priest of the Order of Schuler, promptly handed him a thick folder, and Reyno placed it on the conference table before him. He opened it and leafed through the first few sheets of paper for several seconds. Then he looked back up at the waiting clerics.
This tribunal was impaneled to consider the circumstances surrounding the deaths of 16 consecrated priests of the Order of Schuler, he said. There is no question about the causes of those deaths or who was responsible for them, but certain charges leveled at the priests in question were so serious, so disturbing, that the Grand Inquisitor, with the Grand Vicar's strong agreement, felt a formal inquiry and investigation was mandatory. This tribunal has now concluded that inquiry and investigation to the satisfaction of its members, and is prepared to announce its findings.
It was scarcely a surprise, but even so a stir went through the audience, like a stiff breeze rustling its way through a field of ripened wheat.
According to the allegations published by the so-called Church of Caris, Reno continued, the 16 priests who died in Farad were guilty of instigating the murder of women and children in that same city last August, when King James, in obedience to Mother Church's instructions, ordered the seizure of the Carisian shipping then in Farad. In support of those allegations, the so-called Church of Caris has published what purports to be reports written by those very priests in which they openly admitted their complicity in those murders. This tribunal has considered those reports, including the documentary evidence sent to us by King James of Delpharac. That evidence consisted primarily of what the Carisians claimed were the official file copies of those reports, captured during their vicious attack upon the people of Farad. Needless to say, the initial response of any reasonable man must be to reject allegations and charges from those who have blasphemously announced their own defiance of God's own church. When those allegations and charges come also from the hands of men who have themselves so recently caused the deaths of so many innocent civilians, including women and children, and burned an entire city to the ground, the reasons to doubt the reliability of their testimony redouble. This tribunal is confident that no one will be surprised to learn that the initial reaction of the Grand Inquisitor and the Chancellor of the Council of Vicars was to pay those charges no heed.
Reno paused, and his jaw tightened visibly in obvious unhappiness and pain. Samuel Wilson's jaw tightened as well, if for rather different reasons, as he recognized the theater of his order's adjutant.
Ether, and the Chancellor of the Council of Vicars, was to pay those charges no heed.
Reno paused, and his jaw tightened visibly in obvious happiness and pain. Samuel Wilson's jaw tightened as well, if rather friendless, as he acknowledged the terror of his aunt.
And especially on the inquisitors charged with protecting that integrity. And so, despite his own profound skepticism, he ordered this tribunal to convene and to consider the possibility that there might be some basis to the Church of Caris's preposterous allegations. We have now concluded our inquiry, and we must regretfully, with the most profound remorse and dismay, announce that it is our belief that the priests who died in Farad were, indeed, guilty of the actions charged against them by the so-called Church of Caris.
Both of the Wilsons had already known what Reno intended to announce. To judge by the sudden wave of whispers which hissed its way across the chamber, at least some of those in the audience hadn't. Reno paused once more, his expression one of bitter regret, until the chamber was once again silent.
"Brothers in God," he said then, "it is, alas, true that even God's priests can err. Even the best of men is not the equal of the archangels, and the writ bears ample witness that even the archangels themselves could fall into error. In this instance, there seems very little doubt that the inquisitors of Farad did just that. They did indeed assume the leadership of the parties of Delpharacan troops detailed to sequester the Carisian merchant ships in Farad. And when fighting broke out, They did, indeed, order those troops to kill the Carizians who resisted the attempt to sequester their vessels. And as a direct result of those orders, what had been intended as a peaceful seizure became, indeed, a massacre of innocents as well. This tribunal believes the reports forwarded to us by King James were indeed written by the priests who died in Ferrade. We cannot, of course, know if these file copies are complete, or whether or not there might be some extenuating or exculpatory evidence which was also contained in the Inquisition's files and which was not transmitted to King James by the Carizians. Despite that, the tribunal does not believe that any amount of extenuating or exculpatory evidence could excuse the actions of the Inquisitors of Ferrade. No servant of Mother Church can take any pleasure in rendering such a verdict, yet this tribunal has no choice. It is the tribunal's solemn duty to proclaim the truth, however painful, however much we might wish to avoid that duty, or that the truth were otherwise than it in fact is. The tribunal believes that Father Stephen Gravier and his fellow inquisitors committed these excesses, no, these crimes, not out of any personal animosity or any hope of personal gain. The tribunal believes that their wrongful acts sprang from their own deep and sincere concern over the seriousness and danger of the schism being forced upon Mother Church by the heretical leadership of the so-called Church of Caris. In their zeal to obey their instructions from the Grand Inquisitor, they allowed themselves to succumb to the dark side of their own fallible, mortal natures. Men whom Shan Wei cannot corrupt into sin in their own interests may sometimes be drawn into sin even in the name of their most holy beliefs, and that, this tribunal believes, is what happened in this instance. He paused once more, then visibly squared his shoulders and drew a deep breath. It is also this tribunal's conclusion that at least some of the responsibility for these actions resides not in the priests who actually committed them, but in the instructions those priests were given. The way in which those directives were phrased, the stern injunction to secure the Carizian galleons in Ferrade at all costs which those instructions contained, lent itself to the misinterpretation which Father Stephen and his fellows placed upon them. There is no question that Father Stephen and the other inquisitors in Ferrade grossly exceeded the intent and the letter of those instructions. Yet this tribunal has no choice but to observe that the Grand Inquisitor's own directive to Father Stephen played a not insignificant part in Father Stephen's later wrongful actions. Accordingly, we must assign at least a portion of the guilt for what the so-called Church of Caris has termed the Ferrade Massacre to the Grand Inquisitor himself. If there'd been a whisper of consternation at the announcement of the priest's guilt, it was as nothing to the reaction provoked by Reynaud's last sentence. There were gasps, hisses of surprise, even one or two half-voiced imprecations. Reynaud let them die most of the way away, then cleared his throat once again. The sound wasn't especially loud, but it produced instant silence, and he continued. The tribunal's conclusions concerning the actions of Father Stephen and his fellow inquisitors, and concerning the extent to which the Grand Inquisitor's instructions may have contributed to them, will be formally communicated both to the Grand Inquisitor's office and, at his own specific instruction, directly to the Chancellor and the Grand Vicar as well. In addition to determining the facts about those actions, however, This tribunal was also charged with investigating the deaths of the inquisitors in question. The Carizian admiral who destroyed Faraid has confirmed, by his own words, that he personally ordered the executions, and, moreover, that he did so upon the express instructions of the excommunicate Caleb and Charlian of Garris. The tribunal does not intend, at this time, to issue any formal conclusions about the devastation and civilian death and suffering visited upon the innocent citizens of Faraid by that same admiral. Those matters lie beyond the scope of this tribunal's charter, and it is the tribunal's understanding that King James is conducting his own inquiry, and will share its conclusions with Mother Church when it is completed. Nonetheless, this tribunal is charged with investigating and reporting upon the actual circumstances of the Faraid Inquisitor's deaths, and it is the inescapable conclusion of the tribunal that, notwithstanding the guilt of the inquisitors in question, their executions constitute, in fact, acts of cold-blooded and most impious murder. The Holy Writ itself, in both the Book of Langhorne and the Book of Schuller, establishes for all time that Mother Church, and specifically the Office of Inquisition, is responsible for judging the actions of God's priests, for determining guilt or innocence when those priests stand accused of crimes, and for the execution of judgment upon them if they are found guilty. That solemn responsibility and duty resides solely in Mother Church and the Office of Inquisition. Any man who sheds the blood of a consecrated priest upon his own authority, or that of any mortal entity, stands guilty before Schuller, Langhorne, and God himself of murder. Not simply of murder, but of blasphemy. It is an act of defiance, not of mortal, fallible humanity, but of God and his holy archangels. There can be no doubt, no question, of the blood guilt the so-called Church of Carus must bear in the eyes of Mother Church, of all godly men, and of God himself. His voice was harsh as hammered iron, and he swept his cold, hard eyes across the chamber. It may be that Shanwei tempted Father Stiven and his fellows into sin by appealing to and twisting their determination to do God's will, as they understood it upon the basis of their instructions from the Grand Inquisitor. No doubt their immortal souls will pay a heavy price because of their grievous failure, and no priest of Mother Church can condone their actions. Not when those actions led not simply to the deaths of self-professed heretics, but to the deaths of children who had no choice, no voice in their parents' actions. The blood of such innocent victims must stain even the most devout of souls. But even though all of that be true, the men who slew those priests were guilty of an even darker and more heinous crime. They hanged Father Stiven and his fellows, hanged consecrated priests of God in the white-hot fury of revenge. In the passion of their own blasphemous bloodlust, they overstepped the bounds God himself has set upon mortal men. There can be no pardon for actions such as that, and the day must surely come when they will answer both to Mother Church and the Inquisition and to God for their unforgivable sins.
7. A Cotton Silk Plantation, Barony of Derwin, League of Coruscant.
"So they're finally on the move," Sir Corin Garvey murmured.
He stood on the shady veranda of the cotton silk planter's house his staff had commandeered for his headquarters. The house,
obviously that of a wealthy man, was finely furnished, if on the small side for the headquarters of an entire army. On the other hand, a back corner of his mind reflected, his army was on the small side for anything one of the great mainland realms like Harchong or Sittermark would have used that particular noun to describe. And at least Caleb's army seems to be even smaller than mine is. That's something, at any rate. "How reliable are these reports, Alec?" he asked in a louder voice, looking up at the handsome, splendidly dressed man standing beside him. Garvey had known Sir Alec Arthur, the Earl of Windshire, since boyhood. They'd been good friends for many years, and there was no one Garvey would rather have at his side in a fight. Unfortunately, for all of his pugnacity and undeniable courage, Windshire wasn't the most brilliant man Garvey had ever met. He took his responsibilities seriously, he had a seemingly boundless store of physical energy, and he was the most superb horseman Garvey had ever seen. Give him an enemy across an open field, a saber in his hand, and a troop of cavalry at his back, and he was invincible. He was a little shakier where the reconnaissance and screening aspects of the cavalryman's profession were concerned, however, and his natural preference when faced by an enemy position was to attack first and figure out what the odds had been for his after-battle report. On the other hand, he'd taken enough hard knocks to be aware of his own weaknesses.
"I think they're very reliable," he said now. "My lead regiments had them under observation since they left Deiros. We haven't been able to keep scouting parties operating along their flanks since they headed into the woods, but we're still falling slowly back in contact with their advance guard. From the route they've taken so far, they're definitely headed for Talbor Pass, and you were right, they don't seem to have much cavalry of their own."
Windshire sniffed.
"If it came down to a straight fight between my troopers and theirs, we'd be done before lunch."
"But it isn't going to do that, is it, Alec?" Garvey asked, and Windshire shook his head gloomily.
"Probably not. Although," the Earl brightened noticeably, "if you and Charles manage to break their formations, my lads and I will be delighted to finish them off for you."
Garvey smiled, but the smile faded into a frown as he considered one, in particular, of the dispatches Windshire's cavalry screen had sent back to him.
"What do you make of this, Charles?" he asked the man lounging back in a commandeered chair on the other side of the improvised map table.
Garvey tapped the offending dispatch with an index finger, and the other man shrugged.
"Pretty much what you do, I expect," Sir Charles Doyle said.
He was several years older than Garvey or Windshire, and he owed his present position to the fact that he was one of Prince Hector's favorites. On the other hand, he'd become one of the prince's favorites because of his penchant for accomplishing difficult tasks. The tall, rangy, dark-haired Doyle was more noted for indolence than physical hardihood, but he had all of the intellectual sharpness Windshire often seemed to lack. His role as Garvey's senior artillery officer suited him well, and between the two of them, he and Windshire normally formed a remarkably effective sounding board for Garvey's strategy sessions. He was also, however, unfortunately fond of the occasional cryptic comment, and Garvey made a rude gesture in his direction.
"Perhaps you'd care to be a bit more specific," he suggested.
"It's exactly what your father discussed with us," Doyle said with a shrug. "We went for the short-barreled guns. From what Alex's scouts are telling us, the Carizians went for longer tubes. It doesn't sound like their field guns are built to exactly the same pattern as naval guns. The barrel length is too short for that, assuming the scouts' estimates are accurate. But they're longer than ours are, and that means they're going to outrange us, that's for sure. Whether that range advantage is going to make up for how much lighter their shot are going to be is more than I could tell you at this point, though.
There's simply no way to know before we actually start shooting at one another, unfortunately.
You're right. That is what I was thinking, Garvey admitted.
Corin, I know I always prefer going straight ahead and damn the consequences, Winshare said. And I know that more than once I've managed to land myself up to my arse and slosh lizards by doing just that. But I've got to say, they're coming to us on our terms. I think we've got to hit them, and hit them hard.
Garvey nodded. Winshare's awareness of his own weaknesses, as well as his strengths, was one of the better things about him. And he was right. His tendency to charge straight ahead had led him to the very brink of disaster more than once. Not just on fields of battle, either. And Garvey's lips tried to twitch into a smile, despite the seriousness of the current moment, as he recalled some of the dashing Earl's other misadventures. Winshare's rakish good looks, added to his impetuosity and taste for the ladies, had led to at least one duel, fortunately without any fatalities on either side, and generally kept him in constant hot water for as long as anyone could remember. Indeed, there'd been occasions in their shared youth when he'd very nearly taken Garvey into amorous disaster with him as well. But this time, Alec had a point, Garvey thought. The whole reason for advancing this far from the Dark Hills was to attack the Carizian invaders as quickly and as vigorously as he could, and, if possible, drive them straight back into the sea.
Of course, another reason for attacking them is to find out just how badly we've underestimated whatever new capabilities they've developed for their marines, as well as their navy, he reflected.
He looked back down at the map. He'd advanced with no more than a third of his total force, and he wondered again if he'd been wise to do so. The problem was that the roads through the Dark Hill Mountains weren't very good. That was especially true of the smaller flanking roads, and while the Royal Highway itself wasn't too bad, there was a distinct limit to the number of troops which could be moved rapidly along it without using those flanking roads. Worse, that cramped cluster of roads was his only really reliable supply line as well, now that Deros was firmly in Carizian hands. He could probably have gotten a larger percentage of his forces forward, but only at the expense of making it extraordinarily difficult to keep them fed and supplied with ammunition and weapons once he had them deployed. Not to mention just how ugly things could get if that many men suddenly found themselves trying to retreat simultaneously. He gave a mental shudder as he imagined the scenes of chaos, congestion, and panic which were all too likely to ensue under those circumstances. But does worrying about what would happen if I have to retreat mean I'm going into battle already half defeated in my own mind? Is thinking about it prudence or cowardice? It was amazing all the ways a man could find to doubt and second-guess himself. And whatever the limitations of the roadways in his own rear might be, the road over which the Carizians were currently advancing was even worse in many ways. So, if they were the ones who had to retreat...
I think you're right, Alec, he heard himself saying. And if they're kind enough to keep coming to meet us, especially without an adequate cavalry screen of their own... Then I think we should plan on greeting them right about here.
He tapped a symbol on the map, then bent closer to peer at the name.
Harrell's Crossing, he read aloud.
Huh? Doyle climbed out of his chair and leaned forward, studying the map. The town Garvey had selected wasn't very large. Its total population, including the outlying farm families, probably didn't exceed 4,000, and many of them had found urgent reasons to be elsewhere once armies began heading in their direction. It sat directly on the Talbor River, which flowed out of the mountain gap of the same name, where the Royal Highway crossed the stream on a stone bridge. The artillerist considered the terrain east of the river thoughtfully for several seconds, then nodded.
It looks reasonable to me,
he agreed. This might be a bit of a problem if things don't go smoothly, though. He indicated the single stone bridge. There's what looks like a fairly big wooden bridge down here to the south at Harrell's Priory, Garvey countered, waving his finger at another map symbol, this one representing a substantial monastery. It lay south of Harrell's Crossing and on the western side of the river, where the foothills of the Dark Hill Mountains began to rise. There are fords north of the priory as well, according to the map at any rate.
Let me see it, Windshare requested.
He bent over the map, lips pursed, then looked back up at Garvey.
I've got a report somewhere about this wooden bridge, he said. It's not in very good shape, if I'm remembering correctly. We could probably get infantry across it, but only a lunatic would try to take cavalry or artillery across. On the other hand, I think my scouts also indicated that the river is pretty shallow along here, where the map shows your fords. I know we could get cavalry across, even without the bridge, although I wouldn't want to make any promises about infantry without double-checking. And we definitely don't want to take any of Charles's artillery across this thing.
Do any of Sir Ferrach's militiamen know the area well enough to provide us with more information? Doyle asked.
I can check, Windshare replied. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they do, though. They've been remarkably helpful so far.
The Earl sounded almost bemused, as if he still found it peculiar that the Baron of Derwin's men had been so useful. Garvey wondered if part of that was because of how unsoldier-like the Baron's militia were. They were obviously civilians who intended to go back to being civilians as soon as they possibly could, and they didn't care who knew it. At least, equally obviously, some of them, like the inhabitants of Harrell's Crossing, would have preferred to be somewhere else, anywhere else, if it came to that. But they appeared to feel a degree of loyalty to their baron which was rarely seen, and their assistance not simply as guides, but as go-betweens for the army and the local farmers as well, had been invaluable. No farmer ever really wanted to see an army, any army, marching through his district, and unhappy locals could create all sorts of problems if they put their minds to it. So far, at least, the ability of Derwin's men to put a friendly face on Garvey's army had kept that sort of thing from happening. Whether it would remain effective once the two sides came to grips and combat started turning fertile fields into wastelands was an entirely different question, of course.
And one to which the answer is almost certainly no, Garvey thought sourly. I'm sure they'll have some useful additional information, he said aloud. Please do check with them.
Windshare nodded, and Garvey returned his attention to the map.
I take your point about the bridge, Charles, he said reflectively, folding his arms while he contemplated the terrain once more. And fighting with a river in your rear is usually considered a bad idea, even when you don't have to worry about getting artillery across a single bridge. Still, if we take up a position on this side of the river, then whoever's in command over there is going to stop on his side and send back for reinforcements, which means we'd have to fight our way across the river to get at him.
It also means he'd have to fight his way across to get at us, Doyle pointed out. And the longer he stays put out here, the longer your father and Prince Hector have to get more troop strength transferred to us.
Unless Caleb decides to just sit here with a part of his army and demonstrate how determined he is to attack us while he's actually loading all the rest of his troops back aboard his transports to strike directly at Manchir, Garvey replied. And as far as getting more troops to us, how are we going to feed and supply them all through Talbra Pass? That's over 25 miles of narrow road and bottlenecks, especially as you get towards the eastern end. We could feed our entire army through the western half, but I doubt we could support more than 30,000 men on this side of the mountains,
Not if they're going to have to sit in one place for very long, at any rate. We'd run out of forage pretty quickly, and somehow I don't think even Baron Derwin would be able to keep the local farmers friendly once we've eaten all their cattle, trampled all their crops, and emptied all their granaries.
And seduced all their daughters, Windshare added with a grin.
Besides, we're supposed to do it my way, you know, charge straight in and smash everybody up instead of trying to get fancy.
And hitting them on their side of the river will at least give us a chance of catching their advance guard and cutting it up in isolation, Garvey agreed with a nod. If Alex's scouts are right, they can't have more than a couple of thousand men, 5,000 at the outside. We've brought over 20,000 with us.
And how many of them are still west of the river at the moment? Doyle countered.
If everyone's where they're supposed to be, and you know as well as I do how likely it is that none of our movement orders manage to go astray for a change, we've got roughly 14,000, including 7 batteries of your field guns, either east of the river already, or close enough to be there by nightfall. That ought to be enough to take care of 5,000 Carizians, especially since they seem to have only 3 or 4 batteries with them.
Unless they speed up a lot, most of their column won't be here until late tomorrow morning. Maybe not even until early afternoon, Doyle pointed out. We could get almost everybody across by then if we worked at it.
No, Garvey shook his head. There's no point wearing the men out, not to mention probably getting a lot of them lost, marching around after dark. Besides, 14,000 men and 35 guns ought to be enough to get the job done. Piling in still more men would only cramp our mobility. And if 4 or 5 to 1 odds aren't enough to get the job done, I don't want to complicate things if we have to retreat.
Doyle and Windshare both looked at him as if they weren't quite certain they'd heard him correctly, and he snorted sourly.
"Let's do this my way," he suggested. "We'll see what happens. If they bring up more strength of their own, then I'll think seriously about putting still more of our men across the river before we attack. But if they're as short on cavalry as they seem to be, then their scouting has to be spotty at best. They probably don't have a clue how many men we've already managed to concentrate in front of them. If we can keep it that way, keep them confident enough that they don't stop their advance guard where it is until they can reinforce it, I think we can hit them tomorrow morning. With any luck at all, we'll roll right over them and smash them up quick and dirty. To be perfectly honest, that's what I expect to happen. But let's not forget that everybody expected Duke Blackwater to smash up Harald's navy, too. I don't see any way they could be hiding some sort of secret weapon from Alex's cavalry. But I'm not going to rush to any potentially unfortunate assumptions, either. This will let us test the water without getting in too deep. If we're right, we crush their advance guard, and Alex's cavalry gets to spend the afternoon riding down and sabering fugitives. If it turns out that they do have some horrible surprise waiting for us, we lose, at worst, a fifth part of our total force.
Windshare looked moderately rebellious, but he nodded without further argument. Doyle cocked his head, contemplating the map once more, then shrugged.
"I think you're probably worrying more about surprises than you need to," he said. "On the other hand, given your reminder about what happened to Blackwater, I can live with a little overcaution. Better that than the reverse, at least. And to be honest, I'd prefer to blood my gunners under the most benign conditions we can arrange. I think they're ready, but none of them have ever been under fire as a unit before."
"I think they'll do just fine, Charles," Garvey said. "Believe me, my over-caution doesn't have a thing to do with any concern over the quality of our troops, especially of your gunners."
"I never thought it did," Doyle assured him. "That doesn't mean it isn't something else to bear in mind, though."
I'd like to spend some time this afternoon actually looking at as much of the terrain as possible, Garvey continued, turning back to Windshear. I'll need a cavalry escort. You wouldn't happen to know a good officer to put in command of it, would you, Alec?
As a matter of fact, I would, Windshear told him with a grin, then glanced at Doyle. Would you care to come along with us, Charles?
Windshear's tone was more than half-teasing, given Doyle's well-known aversion to any unnecessary physical activity. To his surprise, the older man promptly nodded.
As a matter of fact, I'd like to check my impressions from the map against the actual terrain. There are a couple of places that look pretty close to ideal for artillery deployment. I'd prefer to make sure they really are good positions before I order my people into them, though.
Excellent, Garvey said approvingly. Charles, show Alec the spots you particularly want to see. I've got to go draft a couple of dispatches for Father and the Prince before we go wandering off. Alec, once you and Charles have discussed where we need to go and what we need to see, make sure we really do have an adequate escort. I'm not feeling especially vain this afternoon, but it occurs to me that if the army loses its senior field commander, his cavalry commander, and the closest thing we have to a genuine expert on field artillery, it wouldn't be the very best possible beginning to our campaign, would it?
If we let that happen, Doyle said with a smile, the only good thing I could see about it would be that all three of us would be safely dead, which would at least spare us from your father's analysis of all the truly stupid things we must have done to bring it about.
And what exactly in my record to date convinces you that I'm not fully capable of doing truly stupid things, if I put my mind to it? Garvey inquired.
8. Emperor Caleb's Headquarters, City of Daros, Barony of Derwin, League of Coruscant.
I wish we were up against the Temple Guard, Caleb Armok grumbled as he stood looking down at a map of Coruscant.
Dare I ask why you'd prefer that? Merlin inquired.
Because Elaine Magwyr is an idiot and Corin Garvey isn't, Caleb replied succinctly, in something very like a growl.
No, he isn't, Merlin agreed, stepping closer to the map table. He and Caleb were alone for the moment in the library of the Baron of Derwin's townhouse. It was a palatial temporary home for Caleb's headquarters, although their reluctant host had managed to take at least some of his most valuable knick-knacks with him. Caleb didn't really begrudge Sir Farrakh his personal treasures, however. After all, the Emperor had the Baron's entire city in exchange. Baron Derwin had been unable to deny any of the points Caleb had made in his final note to him. And, to give him his due, his concern over what might happen to the citizens of his barony's capital if it had come down to fighting in the streets had played a major role in his decision to surrender Daros to Caleb. He himself, however, hadn't been included in the package. He'd delegated authority to the city's mayor to treat with Caleb, while he and his personal armsmen had hastily mounted and galloped off towards the Dark Hill Mountains, evading Clarake and Haman's marines en route. Most of Caleb's men, and at least some of his officers, had taunted Derwin in absentia for his cowardice. Caleb didn't agree. Daros might have fallen, but the Baron was responsible for defending the rest of his barony. Besides, he'd clearly recognized how valuable his first-hand report would be to Prince Hector, or at least to Sir Corin Garvey. At this particular moment, the Baron had joined Garvey, and his armsmen and the subjects of his barony who'd been pressed into service as militia were busy serving as Garvey's local guides, which, Caleb admitted, was probably the most useful thing they could possibly have been doing for the other side. Over the last 6 days, The majority of Caleb's Marines had been landed. Deros couldn't possibly have absorbed 50,000 men, even if the citizenry had been happy to see them. Aside from a strictly limited garrison, whose primary responsibility was keeping the peace, the Carizian troops had poured through the city like water through a net and settled